Hello, welcome along. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, part of Faith Explored. Welcome along, whoever you are, however you're listening, and a fantastic discussion today on the programme that aims to get you thinking between a Christian and a non-Christian. I'll be explaining who they are and what we're talking about in just a moment's time. But if you're new to Unbelievable and you don't know, then you can find out much more about the programme and interact with lots of past programmes at our website. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Find out what happened last week, in the last month, in fact, in the last 6 years, if you subscribe to the podcast. Great place to go for that. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. That's also got links, of course, to our Facebook and Twitter page. You can also find links to our apologetics conference from last year. And excitingly, we're having another one in 2014. Going to bring you, hopefully, a bit of detail on that next week. So if you're excited about Unbelievable, the conference 2014, you can find out more next week. But for the moment, let me introduce today's guest.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, does our experience of life make sense without God? That's the question we're asking. In his new book, The Experience of God, David Bentley Hart plumbs the depths of humanity's experience of the world as powerful evidence for the reality of God. At least that's what the PR says. He draws on three principal metaphysical moments: being, consciousness, and bliss. And he's going to be with us on the line from the States where he lives to talk about that on today's programme. In conversation with David today is atheist philosopher Richard Norman. He believes that Hart doesn't have the evidence he thinks he has for the reality of God. Just to give them a little bit of background each, David Bentley Hart is an Eastern Orthodox scholar of religion, philosopher, writer and cultural commentator. He was last on the programme talking about his book that won the Michael Ramsey Prize called Atheist Illusions, looking at some of the myths, historical myths that sometimes get painted about Christian history. He's taught at University of Virginia, Duke Divinity School, and elsewhere. Richard Norman, my other guest on the show today, with me in studio, is Emeritus Professor of Moral Philosophy at the University of Kent. He's also a Vice President of the British Humanist Association. He's also written a number of books. And, of course, I will make sure there are links from today's show on the webpage to both my guests if you want to follow up more about them. Richard joined me a few months ago to do a discussion with Peter Kraft on a not dissimilar topic to the one we're discussing today. So that's our guests, that's our subject. Does our experience of life make sense without God? As we look at this new book, The Experience of God by David Bentley Hart. Well, I'll come first of all to you, David, and say welcome along to the show. Thank you for coming back on.
Thanks for having me.
Do you want to just give us a bit of background for those who aren't familiar with you? What was your journey? Did you grow up within a Christian faith? Was that something you came to later on?
No, I was raised Christian. I was raised Episcopalian, a fairly high church tradition in Maryland, and I became Orthodox later in life. And of course, I went through my periods of doubt and rebellion. The reason I went into religious studies sometimes theology, but that secondary interest was actually a personal desire to figure out what I believed about the world. But I can't pretend that I started from a position of no convictions and then arrived at a conversion experience and amazing grace began pouring out of my lips. I was raised in a Christian family, to the degree that Anglicans are Christians. My father was a very devout man. My father had just passed away a few months ago, sadly. A man of great kindness, and I think that his wisdom and his faith together made it impossible for me simply to reject the idea of God out of hand. It was something I had to pursue. Had I not been raised a Christian, did I not have a feel for what religious life is from within, if its ideas didn't make sense to me in a more than arid and intellectual way, I might not be a Christian today. So quite often we end up where we began. So I can't claim a sudden moment of awakening.
What took you in the direction of the Eastern Orthodox Church?
Well, the classics background. So I was exposed to the Greek fathers earlier. And of course, if you're Anglican, patristic scholarship is always part of the tradition for various historical reasons. Something of a Russophile, and I think the emphasis on the mystical and the spiritual life, not to the detriment of the life of reason or practical application, but nonetheless it has a centrality in Eastern tradition that appealed to me. And I just naturally gravitated in that direction. It wasn't some sort of great existential crisis. I didn't break with Anglicanism so much as I seemed simply to move in a direction that made sense to me at every level of my experience.
Okay. We're going to get into the meat of what the new book is all about in a moment's time. First of all, though, a time to say a warm welcome as well to Richard Norman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming back on, Richard.
Nice to be here.
Just for the record, for those who perhaps didn't hear you last time, do you want to give us a quick background as well? Because I think you were raised in the Methodist Church.
I started off as a Baptist, actually, for 10 years, the first 10 years of my life, and then started going to the Methodist Church, and like David, then started, as it were, dealing with my own doubts, and of course dealt with them in a different direction, and it was those doubts that in my case took me into philosophy, and took me towards a realization that actually the beliefs that I'd been brought up in weren't ones that I could sustain and could honestly say that I believed in. And interestingly, since we're talking about our parents, I gradually came to realize that actually my parents had never really believed it at all, but they thought it would be very nice if I could, even though they couldn't. My mother used to say, "Oh, how nice it must be to have faith. I really wish I did."
Right. That's the background to your own lack of faith now, non-faith.
Yes.
Do you ever wish that you could believe, or are you very happy to call yourself an atheist?
I'm happy to call myself an atheist, yes. Though, as I hope we can explore in this discussion, I'm fully open to recognizing the richness of the religious tradition and looking for ways in which atheists can draw on that tradition from their own perspective.
So you don't embrace all aspects of, I think, the aspects of atheism that David Bentley Hart criticizes in the book to some extent, the new atheism
well,
and so
atheism
on.
Atheism is a broad church like every other church. I think that's important to recognize.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the central question that we have at hand. And I'm going to give you each a chance, a few minutes each, to sort of lay out your cards, as it were, on the table at the beginning of this program. So starting with you, David, just on that question of does our experience of life make sense without God, could you give your opening thoughts on that?
Yes, I suppose I can, and try not to be too irascible sounding, since apparently this is a danger for me.
And
of course, even in the book, my reputation is for provocative formulations, but a gentle spirit.
Good.
The provocative formulations are mostly reactionary. You know, you listen to A.C. Grayling for a few days. And, can we make sense, or does our experience of life make sense? I mean, there are two different ways of formulating it. One, I suppose, is can we make sense, that is, as an exertion or a feat of will or of imagination of life without reference to God? And of course, we can. I mean, whether we're devoting ourselves to philosophy or, you know, macrame and gardening, or whatever it is, the things that we can put together to make our lives rich and intelligible sequence of moments and ideas and ideals. And we all do this. We go through life. Our experience of life at the existential level is one of a sort of bricolage. We're constructing a habitable ethos for ourselves at every moment. And conversely, you can live a life with belief in God that's absolutely you know, shattering. That you know, you can have this the pathos of Pascal, or something more than that. Depending on how you believe, it can become a fanaticism, a cruel and destructive passion. So, at the level of how we live, how we make sense, yes. But obviously, I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't believe that the most fundamental conditions of our experience, I mean, the primordial conditions, or transcendental conditions of experience, that if I won't say dispassionately, because we do nothing dispassionately, but attentively, contemplatively, philosophically, attend to those conditions, to the phenomenology of those conditions, what makes them possible. I do think that we can only arrive at a vision of the transcendent if we believe by making sense that what we're saying is composing the whole of that experience in an intelligible understanding of what that experience entails. Because, you know, as I frankly said in the book, I do tend to think that we are, when we consider even our most basic experiences, always already immersed in the supernatural, that we never get to the natural, but by way of a sort of supernatural interval. So take that answer any way you like. We can make sense of our lives without God. I just don't think that without God our experience is sensible.
tell us what in the book you specifically pinpoint as these aspects of our experience that don't seem intelligible without placing them within a world in which there is a God to be a source for these experiences.
Well, you realize that in asking that, you're inviting me to take up the rest of the program, which would be rude. It would not be untypical of me, but it would be discourteous. Well, rather than try to summarize the argument, I can repeat what you said with a little bit of annotation. The three metaphysical moments, which I borrow initially from a Sanskritic formulation of the nature of God, Sat Chit Ananda, being, consciousness, bliss, a formulation that you find in much the same form in sources and all the, no, not all of them, but most of the great theistic creeds, including Christianity and Islam. I rather than start with those as metaphysical givens, I try to approach them phenomenologically from the ground up, from experience towards, because there I'm simply trying to explain the logic of why. I'm not actually trying to argue in a knockdown way for the conclusion that there must be a God. Rather, I'm really just trying to define the word and to say why it is that these traditions again and again and again arrive at the same sort of metaphysical and then spiritual formulations. That the experience of being and its difference from beings, the fortuity of being, the gratuity of being, the experience of consciousness in all of its distinctive aspects, and the experience of how we take in reality, and here I use the term bliss as a sort of portmanteau term, but as a sort of ecstatic movement of the mind towards transcendental horizons, which I'm very much a continentalist in my philosophical background, but which I really think you can't get away from. All of those realities mean that when we take in our experience of nature, we're doing it within the embrace of a more original, a more primordial, supernatural, if not experience, at least idiom. And I don't know if that makes it any clearer.
It helps at least to elucidate some of the ways in which I think you take our experiences as being significant in the way that you develop it in the book. So thank you for that. Okay. Opening statements, as it were, from you now, Richard. Same question. Does our experience of life make sense without God?
Well, first of all, I'll go with what David said at the beginning, that And I think we can both agree it's possible for people to make sense of their life without God. The important question, and what we're going to be discussing, I think, throughout this program, is whether, as he says, whether there are certain fundamental features of our experience which point towards God, point towards the supernatural, and can't really be properly understood without that. So let me just, again, give my quick two pennyworth on the three aspects of it that he talks about, and then we'll be going into them all of them in more detail. He talked about the experience of fortuity, gratuity. In the book, he uses phrases like existential surprise, existential wonder. And as I understand it, the core experience that he's talking about here is that sense of delight in the wonder of existence itself. How amazing it is that there should be a world at all. And there, I want to say that's an experience that we accept for what it is. To try to explain it, to say, oh, well, I can explain why there's a world, it's because of the relationship of this world to necessary being or whatever, seems to me to actually take away the wonder. That wonder, the asking of that question, it seems to me, isn't a request for an explanation. It's simply an expression of a kind of delight and joy. Then secondly, David talks a lot in the book about our own experience of consciousness, of being a subject of experience, of having experiences which are, as he puts it, first-person experiences, in some sense, private experiences. And, of course, he argues that that's incompatible with a purely naturalistic view of the world. As I hope we'll go on to discuss, I think that it actually points to a naturalistic world. We can make no sense of our own experience of consciousness without recognizing that it has a basis in the natural world, in our own existence as natural beings. So I think that aspect of experience actually points towards the implausibility of the idea of a supernatural realm. And then thirdly, under the heading of bliss, David talks about our devotion to the ideals of truth and goodness and beauty. And I want to say that those experiences are best understood much more in the concrete, in our striving to arrive at true beliefs through our wrestling with the world, rather than aiming at some kind of transcendental idea of truth itself. Likewise, our moral strivings are our responses to other people and our attempt to live a good life in our relationships with other people. They don't depend on some platonic idea of the good. And our experience of beauty, again, is very much immersed in the concrete. And I don't think the notion of an absolute beauty adds much to that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for sharing in those opening statements. If you are listening and you'd like to perhaps respond to anything you hear as we continue this discussion today on Unbelievable, you can, of course, get in touch via email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Happy to also receive your messages via our Twitter and Facebook accounts at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow us on Facebook. And those links, plus, of course, links to my guests and other shows that they've both contributed to that you may be interested in, available from the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So let's get into some of this discussion then. Maybe we need to start by talking about the definition of God, because, well, you've had a chance to read the book, Richard, and one of your concerns was that the way David, as it were, defines God isn't necessarily the way that many Christians would define God. Can you explain what your concern with is, and we'll have David
yes,
respond.
I'd like to. I mean, David says in the book at one point that he hopes that the more amiable sort of atheist may take his book as an attempt to help atheists get clear about what it is that they don't believe in. So I'll try to be as amiable as possible and thank him for the gift. But I'm not convinced, because it does seem to me that the God that he talks about and defines is very different from the God that, as far as I know, most Christians believe in, and which I then say that I don't believe in. And I think the heart of the difference really comes when David makes this distinction between the idea of God as a being, which he says is misconceived, and the idea of God as being itself, absolute being, unconditioned, timeless, absolute being. And it does seem to me that most Christians believe in a God who must in some sense be a being, in particular, must be a person. And I find it difficult to see how God can be a person without being a being, but a person with whom Christians think they can have a personal relationship, that they can talk to, that they can pray to, that they can ask this God to act in the world, to intervene in the world, to further that relationship that they have with him. And it's interesting that, that Christians, and indeed David in the book, use the personal pronoun he to talk about God.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, do you want to respond to that, David, and how you have attempted to sort of define God in the book?
Well, but that brings up two distinct issues: whether what I'm calling classical theism is in fact representative of what Christians believe, but then also he raised a purely metaphysical question about calling God being in the absolute sense and shying away, and so I can answer both, one or the other.
Yeah, well, go for both.
I'll try to do both. Well, let me say, first of all, in his praise of the three metaphysical arguments I undertake in the book, I wouldn't quite agree with the way he represented any of them. I'll just give one example. I mean, the experience of being that I talk about in the book is not just existential wonder. It's that in that wonder, one discovers a distinction between being and beings. What does that mean? Well, he brought it up again just now. First of all, but before I say that, let me say, if you're not convinced that mine is an adequate formulation of classical theism, I would simply say you're in error. Now, part of that might be, you say you were raised Baptist, and I was raised Anglican, so more of a metaphysical content, I suppose, in weekly sermons and things. But if I don't think this is open to question. If you have a picture of God which is the explicit theological and philosophical teaching of every theistic tradition in every significant figure in that tradition, one that you even find in the Roman Catholic Catechism, then in some sense that is going to be classical theism. At the level of common, I don't know, folk belief, does everyone possess the same philosophical grammar in full? Obviously not, but this notion that that if you were to ask the average believer what he or she thinks about God on specifics, you would get radically different answers from the more philosophically sophisticated versions that excite metaphysicians. I'd say that's not true. They may not understand what distinction you're trying to make when you say make a distinction between being and beings, but if you sit down and ask them specific questions, you're not going to end up with a picture of a magic friend who's a sky god, you know, as what they understand God as the source and end of all being, transcending space and time, omnipresent and yet nonetheless transcendent. And you will find that in a much, it may be less refined way, they understand the idea of divine transcendence. Why you would think that excludes personality, I'm not sure, but I'll venture an answer to that as well in a moment. Did you want to interrupt?
Well, I was just going to say, is this one of the issues you have with the sort of less sophisticated brands of atheism, let's say, where you do get these ideas going around, well, you believe in a sky daddy, an old man in the clouds, a magic
right.
man?
Well, it's comforting to believe that's all you have to deal with. If that's the entire issue, as whether or not there's a Zeus, that's a question for naturalists. You know, can you find him? Can you find out where he lives? Can you scale Mount Ida or Mount Olympus and discover his house and see if he likes tea? This is not denying that there's also plenty of folk religion out there, just as there's plenty of folk science out there. Most most people have some sense of Darwinism, for instance, but if you actually ask them for the specifics, you often end up with something like a kind of progressivist vitalism, that there's some essential force in nature that moves towards higher forms. They don't actually... And folk atheism is rampant. I mean, go look at Dawkins.net. But this leads to the metaphysical question, which has been introduced about the distinction between being and beings, and whether that precludes a conscious and personal God. And I want to talk about that. I just don't want to take up all the time here at the beginning. So maybe we can insert a pause.
Well, let's insert a pause, and I'm glad you said that, because we are, believe it or not, coming towards the end of our first part of the show, and we've hardly got into the issues around the definition of God, so we'll have to crack on as fast as we can in the next part. You're listening to a discussion. We're asking the question, does our experience of life make sense without God? That's one way of looking at the new book by David Bentley Hart called The Experience of God, in which he argues for the reality of God, looking at some of the principal metaphysical aspects of our existence, being, consciousness and bliss. He draws these from all the main theistic religious traditions as being the way that they have understood God. And so he's in conversation today with Richard Norman, an atheist professor of moral philosophy, emeritus professor, I should say, at the University of Kent. So we're going to continue this discussion here on the show. Aims to get you thinking, somewhat of a philosophical edition of the programme today. Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley. We'll be back in just a moment's time.
Challenging, stimulating and highly respected. Book your place now for Cambridge Summer Schools 2014. Theology, the Unity of Scripture with Dr. Walter Kaiser. A Biblical Approach to Counseling with Dr. Richard Winter. Apologetics in Contemporary Culture with Dr. Ted Turnow. From June the 30th to July the 18th, 2014. Book before February the 28th and save 10%. Visit christianheritage.org.uk/summerschools.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Today we're asking, does our experience of life make sense without God? Eastern Orthodox scholar of religion David Bentley Hart joins me on the programme. His new book is called The Experience of God, and it plumbs the depths of humanity's experience of the world as powerful evidence for the reality of God. Well, he's been setting out some aspect of how that works, and you need to go and get the book, really, to get the full picture. But certainly in discussion, having read the book with David today, is Richard Norman, Emeritus Professor of Moral Philosophy at the University of Kent. And he's going to be responding in just a moment to some of the issues David's been raising about whether we have a correct picture of God. And David's been defending the view he spells out in the book as the classical theist view of God. But then we've come to this issue of and do you want to just spell out the problem again to remind us here, Richard, that you find it difficult to see how you can have a God who is being but can also be related to in that sense, because wouldn't that mean it is
well,
a being,
yes, I
a
think
personal?
It can, that's right. I mean, I think it can be best put in David's own terms. David talks about the unity of absolute being with consciousness. But what he emphasizes in the book is that consciousness is essentially something first person, subjective, individual. What we experience as human consciousness is our unique viewpoint on the world, highly personal. And I just find that it very difficult to see how that can be identical with the absolute being that he talks about. So I'd very much like to hear what more he will say on that.
Okay, go ahead, David.
All right. Well, that's a question of two parts then. and I would say, just to simplify, or actually to complicate, but to sound like I'm simplifying, that first of all, you have to be careful about what this very venerable classical distinction between saying that God is actus essendi subsistens, the act of being as a subsistence, and saying that he is a discrete being among beings. On the other hand, if you're going to talk about consciousness, and you do mention my own words, I want to point out that subjectivity is not the sole emphasis there. So if you reduce it to a psychologistic portrait of consciousness rather than emphasizing the transcendental conditions underlying that, then I think you get a false problem here. First of all, one thing I found, and this is more true in the Anglophone world, I suppose, than the continental, when you have these discussions, and I don't know why, just different traditions, is the tendency to imagine that in metaphysics that the alpha privative always entails an ontological privation. That is, if you use a negative formulation, then you're talking about an impoverishment, some property. If you say that God is impassible, that's often taken as meaning that he is bereft of those capacities that make human beings and other finite beings capable of experiencing a pathos, so a modification of their nature from outside. Whereas, of course, traditionally, these are meant to be affirmations that God infinitely exceeds the finite conditions in which we experience these things. It's like it's the privative prefix in infinite. We say that there are numbers, finite specific numbers. We say that the infinite is not a number among other numbers in that way, but we're not thereby denying that the infinite is capable of quantity or extension. You know, we're saying that and this is the traditional formulation. The reason you put this alpha privative or this privative prefix on these words is simply to indicate that all the positive aspects that a finite being possesses as conditions of his or its existence are possessed in an eminent, supereminently, even infinitely greater degree by the fullness of being that is God, including consciousness. So, first of all, understand the metaphysical claim being made when you're saying that God is not a being. If you have, well, for instance, two chairs in a room relate to one another in a specific way. One is here, one is there. They delimit one another. They're defined by certain. Whereas the relation of either of those chairs to God is not that kind of relationship, and therefore you say God is not another object alongside them, but all of those finite objects exist because they participate in his being. Now, the second question then is how that can be that absolute being, that absolute source of being, can also I'm tripping over papers underfoot here. That absolute source of being can also be conscious. If in the traditional metaphysical sense you understand being as the supereminent source of all the powers of existence, then consciousness is among those, as perhaps in some ways its supreme expression. But I say you don't even have to go that far to understand that this isn't a problem, because I think that, as I said, you're starting from this sort of psychologistic notion of subjectivity, which is the one I reject. And I would submit, Philip, that even in your own consciousness, approach the world from a sort of, well, what Kant would consider a sort of transcendental apperceptive position, but a transcendental unity that is not, and we'll get to this later, I imagine, not reducible to your changeable, finite psychological identity or your physical or emotional constitution, and that I think, and I give some of the reasons in the book, for countless reasons, cannot be reducible to physical processes, events, apparatus, not even to your empirical ego. So I regard that, the most fundamental act of consciousness, unity and intentionality, as a participation in that unconditional source that is God. I admit this gravitates towards an idealism in which I happily embrace, but I think that if you take the not a being as a privation, as a statement of privation rather than what it's meant to state, the difference of the modality of how we ascribe being to God, then you create the false dilemma, because you're treating it as sort of like an abstract category that then magically also can be related to as a person, and that's simply to impose modern ways of thinking about these words on a tradition that I think is richer and more coherent.
Okay. Quite a full response there to you, Richard.
That's what I said. It opens too many questions.
Anything you want to say in response?
Well, what I'd like to do then, move on from the being a being distinction to talk a bit more about what you do say, David, about consciousness in the book. And I wonder whether we could perhaps tackle some of those questions that you've just alluded to, in which you very vigorously attack the idea that consciousness as we experience it is consistent with any conception of ourselves as human beings as purely natural beings. May we move
absolutely.
On to that topic?
I mean, and if we do, can I just sort of, again, have that sort of spelled out? What you're saying is that David in the book suggests that the consciousness that we all experience as human beings is not reducible to the material world we live in alone.
That's right.
That if we do live in a godless world, that simply cannot account for the nature of the conscious experience we have if it is ultimately matter in motion and so on.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Did I call you Philip rather than Richard?
You did indeed, but that's fine.
Philip Norman was a childhood friend of mine. Sorry.
Well, I'd like to meet him.
I was going to edit that out.
No, you wouldn't.
But can I put a positive claim here?
Okay,
I mean, you know, we're talking here, as you do in the book, David, about, you know, some very pervasive philosophical issues about materialism, naturalism, physicalism, and so on. One thing I do want to just get out of the way first of all is to make it clear to listeners, when we're talking about materialism as a philosophy and how adequately it accounts for our experience of consciousness, we're not talking about value materialism here. We're not talking about living for the possession of material things and physical pleasures and so on. We're talking about materialism as the view that everything that exists is ultimately describable as properties and features and relations of things in the physical world. And if I could actually just put forward in positive terms my own position on this, because I would want to say that the most adequate way of making sense of our experience of consciousness is as what we experience as physical beings. There's first of all the fact which you explore at great length, of course, about the relationship between our conscious experiences and what we know about the physiology of the body, the brain and the central nervous system. And I think it's difficult to deny that in some sense our conscious experiences are dependent on physical processes taking place in the brain and central nervous system. I do want to emphasize that that doesn't mean that they're simply reducible to that, and that everything that needs to be said about consciousness can be said in the language of neuroscience. And that's a very important distinction to emphasize, I think. But the other thing I want to say is that beyond the neuroscience, I'd want to say that once you start to give an account of what it is to have conscious experiences, you inescapably talk about the experiences that we have as embodied beings, as beings in the world, beings who act on the world, who move and interact with the world. And I find it very difficult to understand what sense we can make of the notion of consciousness other than in that embodied context. Can I, without hogging the microphone, can I just give you an example of that? Just take the experience you talked about, the fact that you live up in the mountains in the forest. Take the example of walking through the forest on an autumn day like today, seeing the glow of the leaves in the distance. This may not be your forest, I don't know, but I'm going on the one near me.
Not at the moment, no. It's rather cold and dreary here. Go on. Yeah.
Well, last weekend I had a wonderful walk through the woods. The sun, the low sun from this time of year, creating this wonderful golden glow that I experience as I walk through the woods, and I hear the crunch of the beech nuts from these beech trees under my feet, and I reach out and touch and feel the brittleness of the leaves and so on. That experience of just one example of a conscious experience is intimately tied, you may say I'm taking a special example here, but it's clear it's intimately tied up with what I'm doing as a physical being, an embodied being, walking through the woods, looking at the words from a particular location, from a particular perspective, which changes as I move around, as I walk around. Now, I don't know whether you do want to say that's just a special case, but it seems to me absolutely characteristic of how we talk about our experience of consciousness as embodied beings, as beings in the world.
Well, but don't I, in the book, use exactly that example?
Indeed, that's why I'm using it. Indeed, yes. So the problem is, then, how can we make, how can we give any sense to the notion of consciousness that isn't part of the physical world?
Oh, I see what you're asking. Yeah. Well, should I answer that? Again, there seem to be two issues there.
Well, multiply issues.
Well, I mean, certainly when I talk about our consciousness, and mostly that's what I talk about. I don't presume to talk about God's consciousness the question is, how is that possible? What are the conditions of that experience? Mm-hmm. And that may not be as rich a language as one uses in describing the experience. I mean, I talk a lot about the experience of roses, mm-hmm. but to be honest, no one's going to come away from the book feeling particularly moved by that language. The question isn't how we make sense of consciousness apart from, say, sensation and phantasm. We can't. But we can move, again, phenomenologically from experience to, I think, valid metaphysical, or at least valid meta-phenomenological statements about the conditions that make consciousness possible. And I will say, I mean, in the book, I do talk about non-reductive materialist views of consciousness. It's true say that... Well, no, not briefly. I mean, I go through them. I mean, Well, yes, briefly. I talk about everything briefly in the book because it's not a comprehensive book. But what I do say, and I'll admit, I will own up to this, that the most logically absurd versions of materialism that you get in, say, Alex Rosenberg or the Churchlands or Dennett, in which you just do away, say, well, qualia and consciousness, those are illusions, and then try to make that seem like a sense with endless qualifications. I do say that I think in some ways that's the most logically consistent, even though the most logically absurd form of materialism, because I don't believe that you can have a properly non-reductive materialist view that isn't that remains materialist, you know, and often we have these conversations, reducible becomes confused with identical to.
Yes.
I think that at least it's a modern scientific prejudice, that from a physicalist perspective at least, that there are no emergent properties in nature that are discontinuous from the properties of the prior causes from which they arise, right? Everything is reducible by a series of geometrical steps to the physical attributes of what composes it. And if that weren't so, then emergence would merely be the name of some kind of magical transition between intrinsically disparate realities. But I'm willing to concede that there are plenty of non-reductive attempts to put consciousness in materialist terms. I'm actually this is a strange feeling for me. I'm actually in the mainstream here. You know, I think I mentioned in that book The Waning of Materialism in my bibliographical postscript, you know, one that was edited by Robert Coombs and I think George Beeler. And that title's not bluster. I mean, a lot of philosophy of mind, I think, has been moving inexorably away from materialist models, though not necessarily away from naturalist models of consciousness. And where that will end up, we'll see. The very last thing I'll say about this is that what I said earlier, again, I'm not talking about just consciousness, our experience of consciousness, but the transcendental conditions of that. And I do think, you know, the simple things like qualia, of course, the question of qualia, that is the qualitativeness of our experience, touches on subjectivity, yes, and the difficulty of reducing that to just electrochemical events in a one-to-one correspondence has been argued, I think, quite convincingly against by good philosophers. But I think they're more constitutive problems, things like the problem of reason, an old issue, which I don't think has been adequately answered over the years, how all the sequences, we agreed that the sequences of cause and effect that determine what happens in the physical world in a physicalist model must also determine the physical interactions or the connections of the brain, and how you map that on to the purely semantic and syntactic connections that a feat of logic entails. And more and deeper than that, the problems of the unity of consciousness to me, what is the supreme problem is intentionality. But that would take hours of discussion. but I do think that, you know, the aboutness of the mind, its directedness, its capacity for meaning by which it thinks and desires, believes, represents, it is very, very difficult. And I say this not as a person who's making a religious case, because there are plenty of philosophers of mind like, you know, David Chalmers or Robert Coons or E.J. Lowe or Uwe Meixner, and you can go on, who have acknowledged the problems here. And just the conditions, the question of the conditions of consciousness, not whether or not we as finite beings are immersed in a physical world and convert everything through sense and imagination. That's clearly true. But that if there are transcendental conditions of consciousness, then consciousness is not convertible with, it's not identical to physical experience.
Can I just respond and try and put it in a nutshell, or possibly three nutshells? I'm happy with the notion of emergent properties, though, I mean, you'll probably say that commits me to much more than I want to be committed to. Then, as you say, there's the argument about what Kant calls the transcendental conditions of consciousness, what makes consciousness possible. Specifically, how is it that our consciousness takes the form of a unity, and how can there be such a thing as intentionality, that's to say aboutness? We're not going to have time to pursue that discussion further. All I want to say is that however we tackled those questions, it remains unclear to me how one could claim that they point us in the direction of something supernatural rather than being explicable within the terms of the natural world. But I don't think we're going to have time to take that further. I'm looking at Justin here, and I suspect that's what...
Quel dommage, actually, because, of course, that's the thing I would want to debate.
Yes, right.
Then all I can say is, yes, I do think there is a natural series of logical steps that takes one from the priority of consciousness towards... a simple, eternal, indivisible source of that consciousness. But
if we want, we can do the consciousness thing, and we'll drop some of the other issues that we were going
to
do.
It's a shame not to take up some of them.
Let's go to one of the other. We're not going to get to everything that I hoped we might do, but then that was sort of inevitable. As I say, read the book and then go and look up other resources to continue the conversation. Let's talk about morality, shall we? Because this comes through, comes around time and again on this program. Do you want, maybe the quickest way of doing this is for you to sum up what you think David is arguing in the book, Richard, what your problems are with it, and then we'll let David respond.
Well, I think to continue the philosophical allusions, I think that David is taking a kind of Platonic position here, that ultimately our ultimately our moral experience, and in particular, as it were, the experience of the connection between morality and self-renunciation and utter dedication to an ideal, makes best sense if we talk about that ideal in transcendent terms, in terms of some kind of absolute goodness, which can't be accounted for within the terms of the natural world. I guess the alternative kind of account that I want to give would be ultimately to ground morality in our relationships to other people and our responses to other people. Let me try to put this provocatively. I think my view of morality ultimately comes down to that exemplified by Jesus in the parable of the Good Samaritan, that what counts is our capacity for, ultimately, our capacity for sympathy, for compassion, our responsiveness to other people and other people's needs and other people's suffering. And I don't think we need any notion of a transcendent form of the good in order to throw more light on that. Okay. Let me stop there and, okay. and hope well, so, that that's sufficiently so, provocative.
A quick response, David. We are even so approaching the end of this part of the show, and I'd like to get a bit more.
Well, it's not an either-or. The question is, you say what counts is compassion, charity. Why does it count? And I'm asking that in a formal sense, not in a moral or emotional sense. Mm-hmm. It counts because in addition to that groundedness in sympathy, without which a moral life is impossible, there's something else that can translate that into an imperative that goes beyond charity. And I'm talking, again, just the structure of moral desire. I'm not saying the good is necessarily there. I'm just saying how we encounter the world. It's like the old issue with, say, John Rawls, the political philosopher. The new theory of justice is, you know, we can achieve a just society if we withdraw to an original position where we pretend that we don't know how we're situated in society and then try to construct the just society. Eminently sensible approach. The problem is he can't account within that system for the moral impulse to make that initial mm-hmm. withdrawal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the question for me is, what happens in the structure of moral desire, just as in the structure of aesthetic desire, the desire for the truth? And I'm saying that you're not going to be able to give an account of it that simply rests in the facts on the grounds. There will always be that element that's found nowhere within the ensemble of natural facts, which is transcendental in structure. It's an ecstatic movement towards that which is not simply concrete, but that which allows you to see the concrete. The light of the good is what Plato talks about, and I like that image. It allows you to see it in more than as more than a momentary ebullition of emotion or sense or impulse. But again, it's the structure I'm talking about, how we encounter moral desire, how we experience moral desire. But I'm not trying to deny that it doesn't have a real content. That it's. I'm glad you mentioned the Good Samaritan.
Okay, I mean, let's go to that break before I ask Richard to launch into his response to that. And if you're listening and you'd like to take part as well in this discussion, well, why not email in? Be glad to receive your emails, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Now, there's a lot of David Bentley Hart fans out there. Last time we had David on the show, got lots of enthusiastic responses. Richard Norman, I'm sure, has a fan club as well. And so if you're part of it, I want to hear from you as well. So do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if, of course, you can find us online via the Facebook and Twitter accounts. Go to the website of the show to find out the links to that. And, of course, more info on my guest today. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Going to be continuing, rounding off this conversation on does our experience of life make sense without God? We've covered consciousness in the first part of the programme. We're on morality. I'm sure we'll get to a conclusion from both of our guests in the next part of the programme. Come back in a couple of minutes' time. Welcome back to the third and final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. Though if you're staying here on Premier Christian Radio between 4 and 5 today, then you'll hear me in conversation with singer-songwriter Noel Robinson, find out about his life and faith journey between 4 and 5 on The Profile this afternoon. Next week on Unbelievable, hoping to bring on Justin Lee. He's author of a book called Unconditional, though it was called Torn on its release in the USA. The subtitle, Rescuing the Gospel from the Gay versus Christian Debate. It's going to be a discussion on how the church should treat homosexuality. Find out full details about that discussion. Same place, same time next week. Later on in today's show, we'll hear some of your feedback, and we've had some really interesting comments on last week's programme where the atheist and Christian swapped faiths for a month. They're continuing to do that. So we'll hear some of your comments on that, and also be hearing from a guest of mine, Dr. Philip Lewis, about an exciting apologetics conference in Manchester called Faith Under Fire, happening on Saturday the 8th of February. So stick around to hear more about that. That's after we conclude today's discussion on the experience of God.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding, what's been a very philosophical, mind-expanding and thought-provoking programme today. We've been asking, does our experience of life make sense without God? My guest on the phone from his home in the middle of the mountains somewhere is David Bentley Hart, Eastern Orthodox scholar of religion, author of a number of books, including his latest, The Experience of God. We've been talking in some terms. It's obviously time never gives us enough time on this show to go into any great depth, but about consciousness, we've covered that, many other aspects that David draws upon in the book to show why our experience provides evidence for the reality of God undergirding all of that in the book. Again, if you want more info, go to the website of the show today, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. But Richard Norman, Emeritus Professor of Moral Philosophy at the University of Kent, not convinced, says that David doesn't have the evidence that he thinks he has for the reality of God. We can describe or come to ways of understanding these admittedly mysterious experiences within a natural framework. And we've been talking just in that last section, gentlemen, about morality. Now, this does come up on a fairly regular basis on this programme, the what's sometimes called the argument from morality. I think the book deals with it in a bit of a different way, actually, than it normally gets expounded by many apologists and philosophers. But what did you make of David's response there, just in that last section?
Well, Richard, the question that he raises is, given that we're agreed that in some sense responses of sympathy and compassion are a core to our moral motivation, David seems to imply that's not enough, to which I want to reply, I guess, well, how does contemplation of a Platonic ideal help? I think that seems to be much more remote from what it is that can motivate us and move us to moral action than a grounding in our actual interpersonal experience of our relationships to other people. Now, I agree that morality can't just be a matter of our immediate emotional feelings, but that seems to me to be at the heart of it, and it's on that basis that we then build a more complex moral vocabulary of justice and honesty and so forth. But that seems to me to be the most promising foundation on which to build it.
Well, again, since we're agreed on compassion as being at the center, when I say it's not enough, I mean, it's not enough as an actual phenomenological description of what we're doing. I'm not recommending contemplation of a Platonic ideal as the path to the moral life. I'm saying that that horizon is already implicit in our moral desire and our moral action. And you point to that when you say we're trying to construct a more sophisticated, a more refined ethos on the basis of this experience of sympathy, and we talk about justice and honesty. Well, justice and honesty then become other names for obligation that makes itself felt even in, at times, despite of the absence of sympathy. Can I just say this? I mean, I don't want to be I know plenty of atheists, good moral souls. I'm not in any sense doubting that moral action is possible for those without a formal belief in the transcendent. I don't believe that their moral action is phenomenologically, again, this would leave out metaphysics for a moment, explicable except in terms of something else as well. Mm-hmm. But I will say this. I've been to many places in the world where the absolute depths of despair and suffering are alleviated only by the constant attention and striving of good persons, and for whatever reason, the closer you get to the ground, the deeper you go into those depths, the difference in the proportion between believing and unbelieving persons becomes. There seems to be some value in seeing things in the light of eternity. People who have to change the dressings on wounds or feed the hungry in places where there's no sanitation and things like that, and you could travel the world with me, let's get a grant and go on a binge, you're going to find that the people who are doing that work, the actual hard work, are to a startling degree doing it out of religious, explicit religious motives. Why? It's not that atheists are not good persons. They want to give. They want to do well. But there is some value in seeing seeing others in the light of eternity rather than within the prison of time, the knowledge that life is short. One has only so much energy to give. So even if I wouldn't recommend a contemplation of the Platonic ideal, I would say that a sort of implicit realization that we're working within the realm of the eternal, even when we're working in time, does have practical results which are noticeable.
Yeah,
we're speculating here, but my speculation would be that people who show that kind of dedication are doing so not because they see it in the light of eternity, but because they are sensitive and responsive to real human suffering.
Well, then why are so many? I mean, you know, that's true, and I've worked with many of these people. But it's a striking fact how if you're going to consult them about what they're doing, why their sympathy is so deep, why they're able to feel such indefatigable compassion, why they don't despair and give way, the answers you're going to get are going to be religious, are going to be often Christian to, 95% of the time. We had this problem with the earthquake in Haiti when, Christopher Hitchens was talking about a secularist website and pouring money, and it was good work they were doing. But the problem is just notionally, is when the money gets to the ground, who are the people who are actually on the ground doing the work? They are, to a great degree, to a shockingly large degree, persons who are sustained by this faith. So yes, it's grounded in their compassion, it's grounded in their sympathy, in their natural aptitude for charity. But what makes that indefatigable for them, what makes that something they can persist in throughout life with joy, in most actual, real, concrete cases, is being able to see the transcendent in the imminent and the imminent in the transcendent, and not just trusting their innate sense of kindness. But again, I'm not saying that as opprobrium. It may be that in a more glorious post-religious future, we'll find that degree of tireless charity is a capacity we all innately possess. But I have my doubts.
I mean, that does take us in an interesting direction, which is perhaps slightly beyond the scope of what we're talking about today. But do you feel, I mean, as we're in this position, as we start to draw things to a close, that there are any implications about holding a materialist, naturalist worldview? Do you feel like there are any advantages in the way that David sketched out there, about kind of, yes, living life in the light of eternity and so on, that even if it's not, as it were, any kind of a proof of the existence of God, has some kind of value or weight?
I don't want to get into too much of an argument with David about numbers, and I offer the parallel observation to his that, of course, I don't deny that there are people, you know, whose primary motivation is a religious one, who do wonderful work, caring for the sick and the needy and so on. I guess if I had to give some kind of account of why so often, and I don't know about the numbers, but why so often you find people with a religious background in these situations, I guess what I'd want to say is much more mundanely organizational. I think churches and faith institutions are good at organizing people and encouraging people to act on the basis of the values that they share as a community. I don't think atheists are any less conscious of those values. I guess the problem is that atheists are not so good at organizing themselves to act on those values. That's a rather mundane account of the difference, but it's where I'd go.
Yeah, a couple more thoughts and we'll start to draw it to a close, if you would, David.
There's some truth in that. Organization counts, but I even at the level of people who just do the independent volunteer work who aren't working with any formal organization, I, again, as I say, if you want to do a tour of the world, if you're independently wealthy and want to take me along, we can go to the poorest parts of sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America or all around, and we will find this again. Or even here in a developed country. As I said, my father passed away recently, and at the facility where he was supposed to be rehabilitated, but alas, was not. I mean, they weren't able to save him. There were also indigent people there. And just the people who come in to do the volunteer work of comfort and aid, and not through their churches, not through organizations, but the people who just volunteer their time. It was, and of course I live in a southern state, so that may say something about it, but it was striking that it was basically 100% a Christian exertion for them. So I'm not making claims about, again, this is not an attack on the atheist capacity for morality. I'm just saying that you brought up the issue of whether or not contemplation of the ideal of the good makes it practically more or practically easier to live the moral life. And I say, and my response is just that it seems that some sense of the transcendent, of the eternal, and it does in fact sustain and nourish and make possible a degree of moral heroism that seems lacking, to be honest, in well-intentioned but perhaps somewhat more restive communities.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Richard, thank you very much for coming on the program today. I wish we had twice the amount of time so we could have covered some of the other areas that you had read up on and prepared for. If people want to find out more about you, I know you've got a little biography on the
British Humanist
University
website
of Kent as well. I'll make sure to post those and look forward to maybe seeing you again on another philosophical edition of the programme. In the meantime, thank you very much as well, David, for being on the phone with us today. It's been good to
to
have you. And if you want to find out more about David's book, The Experience of God, well, it's available through all good booksellers. And, of course, so you can find links from today's programme online as well. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Hope you've enjoyed today's programme, and we're going to be hearing some of your feedback in a moment's time. And of course, you're welcome to give us your feedback on today's show as well. I'll be giving the ways to get in touch, and I hope you've enjoyed our discussion today.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
As ever, if you want to get in touch about today's show, then do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I'll try to make as much space as I can for reading some of your responses in next week's programme. You can also, of course, tweet or Facebook the show, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to add your like to that so you can get regular updates, and you can also message me that way. You can tweet me @unbelievablejb by following me on Twitter. Or all the other ways to do that and things to get you in touch with the show available, of course, from the website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Well, we're going to be hearing some of your response to last week's Faith Swap programme, where Christian Bentley Browning and atheist Simon Capes both decided to swap lives, one to try to live as a Christian, the other to live as an atheist for the month of January. We'll be finding out how they've been doing, catching up on what Simon made of his first Sunday at church, and how trying to be an atheist Bentley is getting on as well. It's my pleasure to welcome now onto the show Dr. Philip Lewis. He's behind a new apologetics conference coming up in the Manchester area on Saturday the 8th of February. So just a few weeks away. They've got some great topics, some really excellent speakers. This is at Faith Under Fire, and he's on the line to tell me all about it. A very good afternoon to you, Dr. Lewis.
And good afternoon, Justin.
It's great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for the opportunity.
That's fine. I'm always encouraged when I see events like this popping up around the country. I guess you're one of those people who has found that apologetics has been helpful in your faith. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely, and even more in sharing it. I've been a Christian since I was 11, but if people sort of sent me difficult questions or made comments like the Bible was unreliable or things that were difficult to face straight away. I sometimes ducked, but didn't, if you want, fight back straight away, because I didn't have the material to do so. But I suppose the exciting thing, having spent some time studying apologetics, was that I realized I don't need to duck. And in fact, I was standing on very solid ground for believing. And therefore, that one could not only face questions, but actually go forwards rather than maintain a rearguard action. So it's totally changed the way I go about things.
That's interesting to hear. It's both you and your wife who are involved in this. And
that's
In a sense, it's a passion that's sort of come on the scene fairly recently for you both.
Over the last 10 years, yes, we've realised that, I mean, we've both been Christians since we were relatively young. Since I was about 11. And my wife came back to faith when she was about 18. But we just changed our whole attitude once we realised that you could use your brain and have an exciting faith in the same breath.
It's exciting stuff. So you're part of a website, ManchesterApologetics.com, where you can find all the details about the forthcoming conference on the 8th of February. Tell us a little bit about what Faith Under Fire is about. What exactly will people who attend be encouraged to do, be equipped for?
Well, this is our third conference. The previous two have been done in cooperation with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, but this time we thought we'd go alone. And we're trying to prepare people so they're ready to realize they've got real reasons to stand up for what they believe, real reasons not to be intimidated by people who make contrary arguments. So when people say science has replaced God, or it's unethical to share your faith with somebody or to try and convert them, or the Bible is an unreliable document, you can not just sit there and listen, but you can actually say, no, you're actually wrong. And let me give you some really good reasons why that's the case.
You've got some speakers, a few of them have been on this program in the
past.
Bobby Gilpin, who of course has done great work among Mormons. Tell us a little bit about what John Alistair's going to be doing as well.
Well, as you may know, John Alistair did his first degree in physics at Cambridge. He got a first there, taught science for 7 years at a school in Stockport, and then did a degree in theology and got one of the top four firsts in 2 instead of 3 years at Oxford. So he's a very bright lad, and now he's a vicar in Mapley near Nottingham. And he speaks on science and religion, and he'll be showing that rather than being in conflict, part of the historical reason why we have science as we know it is because people of faith believe there was a united power, united creator, that made one universe with one set of rules, and that it affected the whole of the development of science as we know it. And that's why in Western Europe particularly, the whole business of science burgeoned from the 15th and 16th century onwards.
And your own wife, Brenda, is going to be leading one of these seminars.
Yes.
Is the Bible Unreliable?
That's
Tell us
correct.
A little bit about what she's planning to unpack in that seminar.
Well, she'll look at some of the documents and the reliability of the documents, the fact there's nearly 25,000 fragments from the New Testament, for instance, how there's no way in which they could have been rewritten later, as some people have suggested, that the church couldn't have manipulated the documents to make them look good according to a later faith because they were far too early, how there's such consistency, how the copying of the documents is so reliable, how the archaeological evidence behind them is so robust. In fact, how incredibly impressive it is compared with almost anything in the historical context of the same era. And also how there's contemporary documents from elsewhere making similar statements about Jesus, but from people who aren't Christians as well.
And I'm picking up the fact that you and Brenda are evidently obviously very enthusiastic. And I know that, for instance, in Brenda's case, biblical study is something she's come to and suddenly gained a passion for. And you, likewise, in apologetics have really gained this passion. And you're hoping, I suppose, to pass that passion on to the others who come and attend?
Absolutely, because this is not meant to be a theory exercise. The theory is exciting because it's so robust, but it's really because it gives you a real solid base on which to stand. I suppose I find it exciting that when Dawkins talks about faith, he talks about it being blind. But the word faith in Greek actually depends on the word for evidence or truth. And we're not groping into the dark on something which we can't see or feel, but we're standing on something which has solid evidence, firm reasons for believing it. And if we didn't believe it, we should be the first out, because we want to touch reality. But if it is true, then it's worth sharing, and people need to know how good it is, how robust it is, and how the evidence against just doesn't stack up.
And I notice in the timetable you've specifically set aside time not just for answering the tough questions that often get raised, but on the subject of sharing the gospel and
that's
how
right,
and
yes.
how to do that well within an apologetic context.
The word apologetic sometimes people think is a rather frightening word. It just means the reason for giving a robust defence. And I think that it's all about sharing. It's that the biggest difference to me is not the theory, but what it's done in terms of the way I share and how I can open up conversations and deal with people who've had no faith or have been dismissive or sceptical and say, you don't need to be. Come on, this is wonderful stuff.
Well, it's exciting stuff, and I'm so glad that there is an event like this going on, particularly in the north of the country. I've been supplying events for the last 3 years in similar fashion down here in the south. But if you want to find out about this conference going on in Manchester, then I do encourage you to visit the website manchesterapologetics.com, or you can also book at faithunderfire.eventbrite.co.uk. A modest charge of £15 for waged and £5 for unwaged tickets, but that does include lunch as well. There's coffee and all the rest of it, and it's a whole day of teaching, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, from 10 till 4 on the 8th of February.
Fantastic. All taking place at Holy Trinity Platt, Manchester, M14 5NF. Once again, do visit manchesterapologetics.com for more information. Philip, thank you so much for talking to me today about the conference. All the very best with it. And I do hope that many people will be blessed and will be able to go out and share their faith more confidently because of it. Thanks for speaking to me.
And thank you so much for the opportunity of speaking to you. Thank you very much.
Time for some feedback now on the Faith Swap programme of last week. Bentley Browning and Simon Capes swapping lives, one a Christian, one an atheist, for the month of January. And I've picked up some of the response on their Facebook page to this as well. That's facebook.com/faithswap. Joe said, really interesting show, amazing, fantastic challenge. You both communicated really well. Cecilia wanted to say, my friend is an ex-atheist and Buddhist and experimented with all kinds of religions. She finally became a Christian. Her full story can be found on manashanti.com. Ryan said, show on Unbelievable Gents. May I suggest Mr. Bentley and Mr. Simon read a book by an author of the opposing side during January? For Mr. Bentley, I'd recommend atheist philosopher J.L. Mackey's The Miracle of Theism. And for Mr. Simon, I might recommend the Christian philosopher Richard Swinburne's Is There a God? And you could both do well to read the book featuring Christian philosopher William Lane Craig and atheist philosopher Walter Armstrong titled God, A Debate Between a Christian and an Atheist. Geordie said, hi guys, I found the Unbelievable podcast informative, but was frustrated at the lack of any reference to the core truth of what makes Christianity Christianity. If all you're looking for is an encouraging community of people, then that can be found in many religions or godless organisations such as the Sunday Assembly. However, if you're truly interested in investigating Christianity, it's not simply about adopting Christian habits such as church attendance, prayer, or Bible reading. It's the recognition of your guilt before God and the need of Jesus as Lord and Saviour. Becoming a Christian is a complete spiritual rebirth, not just a tweaking of a lifestyle. Joe says, hi guys, heard about this on Unbelievable, fascinating experiment. Listening to Simon on the show, I think a helpful book for him to read would be The Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology, since that addresses the arguments for Christianity from a more scientific and practical standpoint. For Bentley, he's already planning to read books by Richard Dawkins and so on, so I'd say that's a fair arrangement, although many atheists don't condone Dawkins' methods or militant form of atheism. For both of you, I'd suggest you avoid the fringes, extremes, and low-hanging fruit of either atheist or Christian. Some groups get a lot of attention because they yell the loudest, but in between are where the bulk of atheists and Christians reside, and finding those people will go well for your experiment. Thank you very much, Joe. Simon has given an update, a few updates in the last week on how he's progressed. Here's his update on the Faith Swap page about his first Sunday in church. He says, okay, so it's Sunday and I'm writing this after attending my first church service of the day at the Living Hope Church. I was very nervous at first, not knowing how I'd be received, but my fears were unfounded as I was greeted by Nigel, who was an extremely likeable man who offered me a coffee and a rather delicious pecan slice. I'll say one thing for Christians, they know how to be good hosts. I got chatting to Nigel before the service and told him about the Faith Swap. He gave me some great insights into Christianity, explaining that I will encounter lots of different interpretations of Christianity. He advised me if I wanted to find out about the Christian religion, look at the people. The people and how they had changed would tell me everything I needed to know. He also said the fruit of the Spirit would be present in me during the service. And you go on to describe the service, say it was very unstructured, with different members of the congregation leading parts of it. Various members stood up and shared their experiences of God working in their daily lives. There was prayer for people. There was singing. You say of the singing, being committed to the experiment, I heartily joined in and thoroughly enjoyed it, actually felt connected and uplifted. But the reason side of my brain suggested, well, this may be due to endorphins created by the physicality of singing and having a good time, rather than the Holy Ghost. Before I left, Nigel gave me one more piece of advice to help me on this journey. I only need one prayer to say, God, if you're out there, let me know. So saying this prayer, I shook hands and left for the next service. Interesting stuff. So you can follow both Simon and Bentley as they continue this Faith Swap experiment by going to the Facebook page they've set up for that, facebook.com/faithswap. You can also, of course, find out more about Unbelievable, this show and many others, at Unbelievable's webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Hope you can join me as well next week, same place, same time. You're unbelievable. We're going to be looking at homosexuality. That's the show that is in the offing with author Justin Lee. He set up the Gay Christian Network in America. His new book, Torn in America, here it's being called Unconditional, is subtitled Rescuing the Gospel from the Gays versus Christian Debate. He'll be in conversation with someone who takes a different point of view on the whole issue to him. So hope you can come back for that at the same time next week. Until then, have a good week. If you're staying here on Premier Christian Radio, I hope you'll enjoy what's coming up next, The Profile, as I speak to singer-songwriter Noel Robinson.